Hello everyone, this is Brian Murphy. I'm the Director of the Association of Clinical Documentation Improvement Specialists. I want to welcome you to our latest ACTIS quarterly conference call. Just to recap for those new members or those that might be dialing in for the first time, these are live calls we offer on a quarterly basis to our members. They're largely unscripted. We do have some agenda items we want to go through today, but essentially they're a chance for you to kind of talk with each other, to discuss issues. We have several members of our ACTIS advisory board on today's call that will be happy to try to answer your questions, engage you in discussion. The process is a very easy one. Your lines are muted, but if you have a question or a comment to make, it's a simple question of pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. When you do that, I will be alerted to the fact that you have a question, and we'll take it as soon as we possibly can. So again, that's star 1. Also, the operator would like me to tell you that if you have a problem with your line, you've been disconnected, you're having some other issues, you just press star 0. And that will alert the bridge company that you have a problem with your line. Star 0 for problems, star 1 for questions. I'd like to just take a second to briefly introduce our advisory board that we have on the call today. We have with us today Tamara Hicks, Sheila Bullock, Dr. James Kennedy, Dr. Robert Gold, and Gail Marini. And am I missing anyone else that might have joined us late?
I'm here, Brian.
Oh, and Glenn Krause has also dialed into the call. We may be having some other board members dial in at some point during the call, but so these folks are all here to kind of serve as your content experts and your sounding board. Again, before we get started with kind of the meat of the call, I do want to run through a couple of agenda items and discussion points. First of all, as you may or may not know, we have had 12 original members of our advisory board who helped us found ACTIS back in 2007. Back in the early days of 2007, while the CDI profession was still going on, but it was relatively new. It's still new, in fact, but it was really in its infancy. And these 12 members helped us get our association up off the ground. They helped us develop the website, come up with what resources we should have. They actually, you know, solidified the decision to make this an association instead of a newsletter or a conference. They felt strongly that this profession deserved its own association, its own networking, its own resources, its own conference, and they were integral in helping us launch ACTIS. We're losing those 12 members at the end of this year. Their three-year term of service is up. We kind of have been figuring out the process for the advisory board as we've gone. We are a new association, but essentially what's going to happen is we'll be adding 4 new members of the board every year, and 4 will rotate off. So we'll always have 12 board members on the board at all times. But we do have 20 at this time. We'll be adding 4 at the end of this year to bring us to 24. But again, those original 12 will be rotating off. They are eligible to reapply if they'd like. And they also, I hope they all stay in touch, but you know, their email addresses can be found on the website, and I do hope you wish them well, because they've really been a big reason why we've been successful and have really helped to bring this new profession to the fore, and I'm proud that they've served on the board, and we have a couple of them on today's call, including Dr. Gold and Tamara Hicks. So thanks to those guys. And that does bring me to one other point. We are accepting still applications for new advisory board members starting with a 2011 term of service. We're accepting those through December 1st. The advisory board will be reviewing those applications in the following few weeks. And in January, we'll be naming our 4 new advisory board members. So please, if you'd like to apply, that application may be found on the ACTIS website. This next item, Sheila Bullock wanted me to elaborate on this, so I don't feel too much like a shill, but we have put together what I think is a great conference lineup. As you know, our fourth annual conference will be held April 7th and 8th at the Hilton Walt Disney Resort in Orlando, Florida. Sheila, as well as a group of about 11 or 12 other people from the membership at large, served on our conference committee. They're still serving in that capacity. But they helped us select all of our speakers, brainstorm all the sessions they wanted to see, and I think they've put together, maybe a little bit biased, I probably am, but one of our best lineups ever. We have a number of speakers that you can read about on our website. It's right on the top there. If you click Annual Conference, you can do some tabs that have the speaker lineup as well as all the agenda. A couple highlights, we're having some surgeons out, actual practicing surgeons, to talk about complications. An assistant U.S. Attorney with the United States Attorney's Office for the District of Maryland who prosecuted a documentation-related case will be speaking with us. Dr. Kennedy really helped us with that one. So I'm very pleased with the lineup. I hope you are too. It is in Orlando, and it's a busy time of year at that time. As you know, it's school breaks, school vacations, and we encourage you to sign up early, get your room early, if you are planning on attending. And it's going to be a great time. I was kidding with the board before we got on, and I hope people actually go to the sessions, because it's Orlando, and there's the theme parks, and we're right across the street from a large outdoor Disney-related shopping mall. There's plenty of dining, and at this point, I'll kind of turn off my used car salesman act here, but I do hope you can make it to the conference in April.
And Brian.
Yes.
This is Sheila. Let's remind everyone about the poster presentation.
Oh, yes.
We're still accepting for poster presentations.
We
and
are.
That was a nice additive last year, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think everyone who did attend did enjoy that, and we'd certainly like to have some new poster presentations this year.
All right. I completely agree. Sheila, thanks for reminding me. And we do have a larger space for posters, and we are accepting applications for posters. It's pretty informal. It's just an email to me. And at this time, I have received probably 7, 8, or 9 firm proposals, and we can take up to, I think, 18 or 20. So I encourage you to send that in. Poster presenters are entitled to a 50% discount at the conference for displaying, and it's pretty easy to do. It's just we ask you to prepare your poster, a one-page explanation, and essentially we ask you to just be with your poster on day two during lunch for some dedicated viewing time. Otherwise, you're free to attend all the sessions and do all the other fun stuff, so you're not stuck next to your poster for the whole time. But thanks for reminding me, Sheila. We are having that. A couple other brief things before we get to some of the questions we've received. I won't spoil this other than we are having there's been a lot of requests for a couple days and or a week to recognize the CDI profession. And we are in the process of putting together a CDI recognition week. Just based on a lot of polling and just conversations, our members felt strongly they wanted their own recognition time, their own week. And we have a committee put together. We've met several times. We have a lot of great plans in the process. I don't want to spoil it. We'll probably have a larger announcement at the conference. But we're putting together things like definitive dates, theme, a logo we're developing, some electronic tools we plan to share on the ACTUS website to help get the word out about CDI and the wonderful job that CDI specialists do every day. One final thing, this was a question that was posed to me, and I'll just kind of talk about it now. I think you're all aware, but And Dr. Gold did a lot of work with this, as well as Lynn Spryzak, who I think has joined us on the call, bring it to everyone's attention. But there was a problematic CMS transmittal. It was actually a Medlearn Matters article, SC1028, which is a special edition article that CMS publishes. And the original draft of that article had some language that had a lot of people worried, because it basically said that for all inpatient admissions must have all other or secondary diagnoses essentially identified by the attending physician, which was really in conflict with what Coding Clinic has published and coders and CDI specialists have for years understood. And so Dr. Gold helped bring that to CMS's attention along with Lynn and Shannon McCall on our board. And they've since released a completely revised SE 1028 that has that language removed. So that was a nice change. That's one of the things that our board members do, I'm proud to say, is to help work out difficult issues like that. So at this point, I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'll just remind our members how they can submit questions to our panel. Again, if you have a question for any of our advisory board members or myself about anything I've talked about so far, it's a simple matter of pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. That will alert us you have a question, and I'll be happy to take it when I can. But I want to start off with something that we've received a number of questions about, and it was, you know, I know it was based on a change that CMS made in the last IPPS rule, which was essentially reducing acute renal failure from an MCC to a CC. There was a long discussion in the IPPS rule about why they made that change. It was a non-specified code, and people were reporting it for patients with various severity of illness, essentially using the same code, and CMS opted to reduce that from an MCC to a CC. And since then, we've received a number of questions about how hospitals are coping with the issue. I just did receive a question that I'm going to, you know, put out to the board to discuss. I know that Dr. Kennedy, as well as Dr. William Hike, who's not on the call with us today, have done a lot of work. I believe Dr. Gold has too, with some of the specialty societies about this, also contacting Coding Clinic, because there's been talk about acute, and essentially the question I received today reads, and I'll put this out to the board to kind of kick things off a little bit, but it was acute renal failure secondary to acute tubular necrosis. People want to know what the clinical indications are for ATN and how they can educate their physicians on differentiating pre-renal, renal, and post-renal. This person says they have one physician who always writes ARF secondary to ATN and another one who will not write anything other than ARF. It's pretty problematic, and I'm hoping we can get a little discussion going. From our membership, if you'd like to dial in with any questions, I would encourage you to do so. But I think I might turn this over maybe initially to Dr. Kennedy to kind of begin the discussion on this.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be with everybody today. Dr. Gold and everybody, let's have a discussion. I'll try to be less than 30 to 45 seconds. Very obviously, a lot of hospitals are concerned regarding this, and there's a couple of points that I'm bringing up. Number one, the term acute kidney injury and acute renal failure tend to be regarded as physicians as being equivalent. The term acute kidney injury only goes to 584.9. End of story. If you look in the index to diseases only allows acute kidney injury to go to 584.9, whereas acute renal failure or acute kidney failure can go to 584.5 through 584.9. And therefore, we are advising our clients that the physicians to use the term acute renal failure this year instead of the term acute kidney injury so that it could be potentially linked to an underlying pathology. Bob, can you maybe comment on that from your perspective?
Thank you very much, Jim. The original intent by the National Kidney Foundation with the letter that was sent to CMS asking for the addition of the term acute kidney injury was for code 584, with all of its permutations. Unfortunately, the things that have come out of that did not include exactly what was requested. The goal was that acute renal failure and acute kidney injury are supposed to be equivalent, and that either can be caused by some acute pathologic process, whether it be acute tubular necrosis or acute medullary necrosis or acute papillary necrosis and all the cortical necrosis or some other acute pathologic process. So the intent was to have both terms being equivalent. There is a meeting going on in Denver, Colorado this week, and probably today, in fact, in Denver, Colorado, by the American Society of Nephrology. They are talking about this specific issue, that the definitions of codes for acute renal diseases are inappropriate, and based on the fact that a group called KDIGO, Kidney Disease Improved Global Outcomes, is in the process of reviewing a 320-page treatise on acute renal disease. They are going to come up with recommendations with the hope of implementing them in April regarding a totally new group of definitions and a totally new group of stratification of acute renal disease so that we can finally understand the way it's supposed to be.
But, Bob, let me ask you, what do we do today? I mean, the code set is what it is today.
Yep.
And let's. I know that the future is important, but what do we do today in this?
I agree with you that the term acute renal failure is a valid term, has been a valid term forever, will be a valid term forever, and I don't have any problem with using acute renal failure to describe the overall disease process. If you can identify the ischemic process that causes acute tubular necrosis or the nephrotoxic process that causes acute tubular necrosis, and you are smart enough as a physician to be able to say, well, this is a patient who's in septic shock and killed his kidneys, that's ATN. Or this patient had aminoglycosides and that killed his kidneys and that's ATN. Then, by all means, try to work toward the identification of the specific more than the nonspecific. But also recognize that the folks in Washington are going to see how many more people are suddenly assigning 585.5, and they're going to get suspicious.
Well, absolutely. Now, there is another strategy that we, in reviewing the everybody, at least the way I've looked at CDI, is it's a relationship between the coder and the provider, and that at the end of the day, we are to follow the ICD-9 alphabetic index and the table. If one looks in the alphabetic index under nephropathy, notice that the term toxic nephropathy codes to 584.5, you know, which is the acute tubular necrosis, is the acute tubular necrosis. Many patients will have a rise in the creatinine as a result of a nephrotoxic agent, such as IV contrast, gentamicin, aminoglycosides, amphotericin, those sorts of things. If they say contrast-induced nephropathy, that only goes to a nephropathy code. Yet if they say toxic nephropathy or toxic nephropathy due to contrast, toxic nephropathy due to aminoglycosides, that goes to 584.5. Gail, what do you think of that? Have you had to deal with that, or have you encountered that in your work?
Well, actually, as an institution, as a hospital, what I did, let me start with the original question, is how are we coping? And what I did was involve the specialty MDs and chiefs and gave them a copy of the Federal Register, gave them several pieces of information that was out there, had them gather information that they had, knowing what topic we were going to speak about, and come to a group discussion on what this meant as far as making sure that we documented it correctly, because not having it overcoded was as important to me as undercoded. What I'm finding is, yes, there is an impact that we're seeing from the acute renal failure or AKI, depending on, it's not a one or the other, it's, you know, depending on the situation, it's called AKI or ARF, as we're not seeing a lot of ATN unless there is a toxic nephropathy that's going on. So it's an impact. I'm dying to hear what other people are doing too.
Yeah, that was my kind of question for folks is, I've heard both sides of the argument. Obviously, these are other codes in the 584 range are valid codes. They're there for a reason. They should be used. But the worry is that if people just start arbitrarily using them to offset the financial impact of 584-9 being downgraded, whether that will alert regulatory agencies to it. So it's I think that's why it's really been an issue.
And I agree. I think the Denver, Colorado meeting is definitely in the foresight of my specialist here taking a look at the future. And I also agree that something's needed now that's in place to make sure that we're not over or under doing anything, that we're accurately describing what's happening. And I'm pleased to say that, you know, they're taking it seriously and it's not just a term that's thrown out. And we're looking at it as an institution.
Okay.
One thing I would like to emphasize to everyone is that the initials AKI cannot be assumed to be acute kidney injury.
Correct.
Because that could also mean acute kidney insufficiency. And the Index to Diseases does not have a code for AKI. So if you see the term AKI, a query is indicated to ask the physician what he or she meant by that term so that we can code from it.
Well, thanks, guys. I am showing we have a question. I believe it's from Sandy Beatty, if I'm correct. Latoya, if she's still on, could you put her through? Latanya, I'm sorry.
Hello, this is Sandy. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hey, Sandy.
Hi. My question, I'm very much interested in all the renal discussion. I've been following that closely. At one point in time, I managed the dialysis center here at Columbus Regional, so that's something near and dear to my heart. We worked with our nephrologist and had them define criteria and then go with us to medical staff quality management, which is where all the section chiefs meet and our chief medical officer, chief of staff, and had everyone get on board and approve them there, and then that information was disseminated through the sections, that there was an expectation that when you say this, you're going to define the criteria based on these that have come out of the most recent literature. And so then we update those. Having said that, my question, and this kind of ties into it, is about second level review. I just wondered, as we go on with the discussion today, if different people could discuss what they do second level review on. Do they have a certain tool that they use? How do you accomplish that? Who do you report it to? How does that whole thing work? Because we've never really done that, and I'd be very much interested in hearing what everybody does. Thank you.
Sandy, Jim Kennedy, before you go, I think of second level review more as a case management issue. Can you be more explicit what you mean by second level review?
Yeah. Thank you.
For me, second level review is a reconciliation of DRGs. Second level review is looking at your cases that have a single CC or MCC for compliance.
Okay, I see what you mean now.
That's
okay.
What I'm trying to determine. That's what it is to me. What is it to everyone else, and am I on the right track? Because we've never done anything like that. You know, when we initially started with documentation improvement, we had a contract with a national provider, and they came in quarterly and provided education, and they did audits, and they were very much focused on increasing case mix index. Now, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but my philosophy has become that if you get a quality, accurate, specific medical record that is supported by medical necessity and the treatment the patient received, then the case mix will be what the case mix needs to be.
Bless you.
So having said that, we've never done a second level review. So we no longer contract for reports. We do our own. We're working our way through this. And so how does that work? We have an annual person who comes in and audits for HI, and they have a list of topics, if you will, or types of charts that they're supposed to do a sampling of. And part of that are charts that have been queried, and they're looking at our queries to make sure that we're non-leading, we're compliant, that, you know, if we say someone responded, that they in fact responded in language that could be coded. And other than doing that, we have no compliance measure. And I find that worrisome personally, and so I'm trying to figure out what we need to be doing, and I'd like to know what others are doing. Does that answer the question?
Brian, this is Lynn. I could speak to Sandy about the type of process that we had when I was still back in the facility.
Sure.
You know, back in the day before MS-DRGs, the DRG analyst would do second reviews on those diagnoses that had been identified in the PEPR report. So they would double review every case that was coded with a principal diagnosis of acute respiratory failure, for example, or complex pneumonias or sepsis. So, but the list was pretty short. Of course, now in the RAC environment, the list of target DRGs is about 715 right now. We have 747 DRGs, and I don't doubt that they're all going to make the RAC list at one point or another. But I think what we did internally is we developed more or less our own auditors. We would have someone who had never seen the medical record review take a look at it from the standpoint of, if this is all the information I had, does it look like this CC or MCC or whatever the diagnosis is supported not only by the documentation but also by the clinical presentation of the patient, the resources that were used, and so forth. So for every diagnosis, we were thinking about, does this diagnosis meet UHDDS guidelines in terms of additional resources, diagnostic testing, therapeutic evaluation, and so forth and so on. So I think what we did was, is then we would just, any case that was coded that had only one MCC condition, that diagnosis that would put it into the top tier versus the middle or bottom tier, we just had a second set of eyes look at that record from a worst case scenario perspective to see if the record clearly supported the diagnoses. And you can do that by developing your own checklist or criteria checklist for specific diagnoses. There's a lot of information out there on sepsis, for example. You can find these tools on the internet to do your own auditing. But that's what we did. And if there was a situation where the coder felt the clinical picture wasn't clear enough, the physician champion would review it from a clinical standpoint. So the thrust of this was to make sure that we were moving all the process to the front end, pre-bill end, so that once that record was coded and out the door, we really didn't have to think about it. We had already done our audit of the record. We knew that the documentation was supported, and hopefully you were minimizing your risk area. So this may be something you would consider, is taking your CDI staff and giving them guidelines and keeping them up to date with what auditors are looking for and developing your own internal auditors.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lynn. I always like the good back in the day talk, pre-MSDRGs.
I've got a couple other areas that could be used, and these are things that Lena Wilson, who was the head of the CDI program at Methodist Hospital in Indianapolis, and her other eight hospitals, they use this. Where the documentation improvement DRG disagrees with the final coded DRG, they will always reconcile the case before it goes out the door to make sure that the right one goes out the door. Where there is a high reimbursing medical DRG with a short length of stay, they will look at every one of those cases. When there is a death with a low severity of illness or a low relative weight DRG, they will look at every one of those cases. If you have 3M's product, then you can look at the risk of mortality and you find death with a risk of mortality under 3. That's a chart that to identify and look at. And they also look at all surgical complications and all PSIs coded with 3 sets of eyes before those things go out the door.
Mm-hmm. I believe
this
you do
is,
that.
This is Gail, and actually we call it third review. I think it's because we see them on the floor, and then it's next in the coder's hand, and then there's a validation or third review that we do. It also follows along those same lines. There are focused DRGs, targeted DRGs, mortality also that we look at for low-weighted or short death or length of stay. There's a number of major CCs or CC and surgical, and it's a great process that the chart comes in here pre-bill drop. There's paperwork that's done on it to support it or to agree with it, and it goes back. And we also now do focused reviews on some of our top 10 DRGs or our top 15 DRGs and pick one and search through them to take another look at it.
Thanks, guys.
Brian, this is Tamara.
Yep. Hey, Tamara.
We also have a similar process. Some of the things that everybody else has mentioned, the DRG mismatches, the focus DRGs, the compliance DRGs, the death reviews. Additionally, we also look at the present on admission flags to make sure those are accurate. All of this is done in the pre-bill area before the bill goes out. We also document the compliance one so that if there's ever a question, particularly with RAC, we'll have that documentation that in our process, the CDI specialist has looked at it as well as the coding supervisor, and so we've got that. And in our task force, which is part of our CDI and our coders, we review the DRGs that are on these lists and decide whether we need to keep them on the list or change them out, based on what RAC is showing, what Pepper is showing, et cetera.
Brian, this is Colleen. I came on the call late.
Oh, hey, Colleen.
Hi. I think a lot of us do these reviews, and I think they're very helpful, but you need to take it to the next step, because when you're finding things and you're doing your audits and pull it around and say, you know what, we have a problem with the documentation, or we have a problem with the coding, or we have a problem with the physician's documenting information that isn't really supported by the medical record, and we need to either have better documentation or clear it up, but it's an education point. The main thing is take your information, pull it together, see what the issues are, and do something with it, and not just leave it in the status of, well, we looked at it, and yeah, we need to fix it, and then it gets dropped. I think that's the, you know, closing that loop. And then going through after you fixed it to go back and figure out, okay, you fixed it, so now is it working?
Mm-hmm. And Shirley, we have another question and or comment from Ina Corley, if that's the correct pronunciation. Latanya, could you please put Ina through?
Hello.
Hi, Ina.
Hi. I'm Ina from Tulane with Denise, my partner. And I guess I put in my call earlier when we were talking about the acute renal failure. We have a transplant unit that does a lot of abdominal transplant. We put together a PowerPoint presentation with all the documentation issues, but specifically on the acute renal failure, we gave them the indicators for ATN, which about 50%, greater than 50% of the patients on that unit that have acute renal failure is secondary to ATN. We've also asking all the physicians on the floor, you know, we put a general query when they document acute renal failure or AKI, and we have indicators. We look at the fractional excretion of sodium and other indicators, and we'll ask them if they can further specify the etiology of the acute renal failure. They're getting the picture, and surprisingly, a great amount. And, you know, if they meet indicators, we may have to follow up on the patient 24 to 48 hours to see if they, if it's not prerenal, but they're at least now documenting whether they feel it's prerenal or obstructive or possibly ATN, so we know they're going to follow up on it. But we've had very good results this past 6 weeks doing that.
That's a great success story. Brian, I gave you a reference that would maybe help. Can you maybe speak about that?
Yeah, Dr. Kennedy did present on this with HC Pro with Margie Brown. And my intent is after this call is to post the PowerPoints to the ACTUS website, maybe on either on the quarterly conference calls page and or in our forms and tools page library, because it does contain a lot of information about clinical indicators and a lot more detail that we can probably go into on today's call. But I do plan on posting that to the website. It's just the slides, but I've looked and it's very detailed, so hopefully that will be of help to our listeners.
Allow me to affirm you all down at Tulane on this, because recognizing what the FINA is, what the FINA is, the fractional excretion of sodium, you know, and I guess, you know, the abnormal urines. I guess your nephrologist look at the urines and see the casts and those sorts of things. Is that right?
If it seems applicable, if it's not an obvious case of just dehydration and temporary AKI, if it seems obvious that there's been some ischemia involved or it's a post-transplant that has acute on chronic renal failure with some ATN, because unfortunately the delayed graft function or FSGS, none of those code, and we have patients that are coming back on dialysis and we don't have a codable diagnosis. So when we query them about this, after they do biopsy or just by the lab, they have, you know, they can say some process of ATN, and then it goes to the other code.
Wow. How can we replicate what you've done to a general medical staff or a non-academic setting? Any suggestions on that?
Well, I think a poster, which we have in our PowerPoint presentation that we've presented to all staff, and our queries, our acute renal failure query, which is not leading, it lets them pick anything pretty much. We have a space on there that has been that says other indicators. So if we know what a fractional excretion is of sodium, we can put that as an indicator. But we may talk to them and say, you know, do you know the etiology? Are y'all going to do further tests? And they're getting the picture now, and so they're all doing that. But I think, you know, we're in a teaching facility, and so they're more than happy to do a couple of additional tests. And if the creatinine is staying elevated, you know, 48 hours after and it looks like it's a possibility, they're willing to do it without any leading questions. We just ask them the etiology, and I think they know what we're asking.
That's great.
Ena, if there's anything you wanted to send me after the call, your discretion, but, you know, if you had that poster you might want to share with our other members or something, I'm sure they'd appreciate it. But
I'll email it to you.
Okay. That would be great. I do appreciate it. And this does sound like a great success story you're having there.
And though you are dealing with transplant patients where there's a little bit more sensitivity of the transplant organ to some dehydration, that indeed still the number one cause of renal failure in a transplant organ is still dehydration and ATN that can come from the hypoperfusion associated with dehydration. But there's this one thing Dr. Hike pointed it out to me. I validated it, pointed it out to the National Kidney Foundation, and they're making sure that this appears in the current guidelines, is that if indeed you have a simple dehydration case and the patient is able to respond with a return to creatinine to the pre-dehydration state in 6 to 8 hours with just a liter of fluids or so, that there was not kidney injury, and it should be called whatever you want, pre-renal azotemia or just dehydration.
Mm-hmm. Allow me to maybe change the tone of the discussion a little bit. And for everybody on this call needs to take a look at Coding Clinic second quarter 2003, page 7, because another issue has to do with the difference between code 584.8, which is an MCC, and 584.9, which is only a CC. This question was related to acute renal failure due to lupus nephritis. And lupus nephritis is invariably associated with a glomerular nephritis, sometimes an interstitial nephritis, but invariably a glomerular nephritis. And in this coding clinic, they coded this as 584.9, whereas in my mind, if I follow the coding rules, it should have been 584.8. This question has been proposed to the coding clinic and is on its way to the editorial advisory board. And there's some politics, we believe, to where they're going to land as to whether they still stay at 584.9 or whether they will amend their advice to go to 584.8. And I would just like to invite that everybody read that coding clinic, second quarter 2003, page 7, because this gets into the issue of when is it appropriate and compliant to use 584.8 versus 584.9.
Well, thanks. Thanks, guys. I do appreciate it. We have a couple other questions. Before we get to those, I did just want to maybe put this out for discussion, too. We have probably go for several hours today, but we only have till the top of the hour. But we had a couple folks from ACTIS who were starting to ask about ICD-10 on CDI and documentation. I will just mention again to plug the conference, we are having some sessions on ICD-10. We're having actually Kathy DeVault from AHIMA, who's kind of the head of ICD-10 training, do a session with us. She does the train-the-trainer sessions with AHIMA. We're glad to have her on. We're having a couple of a case study. But I guess maybe I'll just start with the advisory board. Does anybody, has anyone started ICD-10 training, or has anyone started to look at the level of documentation necessary in general? I know it's a big question under ICD-10 and whether or not you anticipate a higher query volume, you anticipate more work, potentially hiring additional staff to adjust. I'll just kind of put that out as a general question. It's intriguing, and it the date's getting closer, so and people are starting to ask about it.
Brian, Jim Kennedy, I'm on the ICD-10 committee for Tennessee, and everybody in the state of Tennessee says CDI is where the rubber's going to meet the road.
Yep.
So I believe that there will be a need for increased staffing. They're already talking about productivity issues, and CDI will be front and center with ICD-10.
I believe that Dr. Kennedy, with his teaching and several of the other folks that we have spoken to on the board, have already prepared their medical staff for increased accuracy and specificity. So the concept of what is needed to get to ICD-10 specificity for diagnoses is not going to be that strange to the doctors. What I have done so far in preparation myself is I've gone through about 10 of the body systems in ICD-10, and I've come up with approximately 20 things that have to be added to whatever teaching that we have now, and that ain't much. If you're talking about strokes, the only difference with stroke is going to be if it's a hemorrhagic stroke, what part of the brain, if it's an ischemic stroke, what artery, and they don't always know, but if they know, that gives all the added specificity you need for stroke. If you go through the ICD-10 book, body system by body system, I think you're going to be able to incorporate into your programs now the minimal stuff that you're going to have to do over the next 3 years. You'll be done.
Well, that's some good news. You hear a lot of some gloom and doom out there. So.
Well, the issue with ICD-10 will be the specificity of procedures.
Absolutely. That'll be a mess.
And what will be important for all of us is the operative reports are going to have to be read to a deeper level than they're currently being read. And the specificity of the anatomy that's being operated on will likely be a growth area in the CDI arena. So the physician, and I'm not fully aware of how, you know, we may not have to deal with excisional debridement like we do now, but we will have to be asked the surgeons to be more specific upon the anatomy that they are operating on.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other comments from the rest of the board, and or if you have a, I encourage our membership if they've started with ICD-10 training, if they've started asking for some of the specificity in advance, or if you've even just begun the research process or looking into, again, some of those major diagnoses, we'd like to hear from you. I am showing some other questions. At this time, I think we have a Janet Gentle. Latonya, if you're, could you put Janet through, please?
Hello.
Hello, Janet.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, most of what I was going to comment on has already been discussed by the Physicians and Advisory Board.
Okay.
I was going to comment, though, on our process here at Northern Michigan Regional Hospital, or a small hospital.
Sure.
We just have, for the second level review, we have 3 inpatient coders and a lead coder who doesn't actually take an assignment but covers for the others. She's the one that does our audits, coder audits and query audits. And if there, we do concurrent reviews, obviously, as everyone else does, and we're continually asking for a reanalysis of the DRG abstract throughout the stay of the patient. And before a final bill is dropped, the 2 of us who are the CDI specialists who are nurses review 100% of the discharges for inpatients, and then can go back and forth with the coders if we have questions or want revisions. If there is a discrepancy between what we want and what the coders want, because as you know, our worlds are pretty different as far as language, and we then refer the case to a physician advisor before that bill is dropped. And we have a method that we discuss it at one of our meetings, our monthly meetings, and we bring it to that meeting for our physician advisor. And I think that's really about all I wanted to cover as far as our own process here, which is probably very similar to everyone else's.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that, Janet.
Thank you, Brian.
Yeah, no problem. Okay, we do have a couple more folks waiting to either leave comments or ask questions, so I will put the next one through. I think our next caller is Lorraine Dion Perry.
Hello.
Hi, Lorraine.
Hi, I'm actually Maureen, but that's okay. I'll take anything. we're also from a small hospital with a newly developing CDI program. And my question is, how do people handle the pre-bill and the pre-bill reviews? You can't get, and getting a bill dropped in a timely manner. We're struggling with a series of secondary reviews, but sometimes it takes a little while to get them done, track down physicians and all. And so how do people strike that balance between dropping bills in a timely manner, assuring they're accurate, and then how do you decide if you're truly going to rebill or resubmit data if you discover after the bill's been dropped that you want to change it? I'd appreciate any processes or comments people have about how they've reconciled that issue, particularly with new small programs that are take a little longer to do things. We don't have people like waiting for those charts to come off the queue every day 100% of the time.
Any comments on that from the board? Any processes or best practices you might want to throw out there?
I think one of the speakers has already come up with would be which is a great idea in my mind. And that is to take all of the areas that you can look at for a focused review, select 2 for now, work on those 2 for now, find out where your problems lay in the first place, work out the corrective action plan, fix that, and then come back and visit those 2 areas 6 months from now and go on to 2 more areas now. And little by little, go through all of the possibilities until you get to where you have to be.
Brian, this is Lynn. I think this kind of speaks to sitting down as a team with all the interested participants. So for this particular area of how long do you wait until you finally drop the bill when you're trying to reconcile or wait for a query response, I think this type of discussion has to involve your chief financial officer and your coding, your HIM director, coding supervisor, CDI manager, coders and nurses as well, so that everybody is all on the same page. But you really need to develop a very specific stepwise policy. So if a query is unanswered at the time of discharge or a query needs to be generated during the coding process, how long do you wait for a response? And I think it's very helpful as a group to sit down and determine what those time frames are going to be. And having the CFO involved in the discussion is very important because, generally speaking, they're the ones who are holding HIM's feet to the fire to get the bills dropped. My own personal experience was that our chief financial officer said, well, you know, if there's potential additional revenue, which is, of course, the main focus for your CFO, she understood that it might only be a $500 difference in the average reimbursement, but that if you multiplied that by all your discharges, that figure became a lot more significant. So the process we had was determined by time frames. So, for example, the physician might have 48 business hours to respond after they were contacted about the query after discharge, for example. And if no response was received at that point, the physician advisor would then contact the physician, maybe they're, you know, for various reasons. And so the follow-up process was very specific as to time frame so that you knew that no record was going to be held out indefinitely waiting for a response. And I think when you get the buy-in of all the involved participants from administration all the way down, then that makes the coding team more comfortable with the ability to generate their own queries or to follow up on a concurrent query that has not been answered. Because, you know, when I was doing this process, it was just relative to a DRG assignment. But, of course, now we have to be really aware that sometimes these physician queries are used to validate whether a diagnosis should be coded or not, whether something is going to better support the treatment and resources, severity of illness of the patient, or whether you actually want to let that go. So a lot of facilities that have been very DRG focused, moving the DRG, capturing the CC-MCC, I think are becoming more aware that the severity of illness is just as important a focus as that DRG used to be.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot, Lynn, for the explanation, and Dr. Gold for your suggestions. Again, any other comments on this are welcomed. We do have a few minutes left, and I did want to at least address this slightly. I apologize not having enough time to maybe get into a full discussion of this, but we've got a question submitted to us prior to the call, and I do solicit those for these calls to help to get the discussion started. But this one concerns, I think maybe Dr. Kennedy mentioned you could possibly address this a little bit, was the AHRQ patient safety indicators. Essentially, these are developed by the AHRQ. They reflect quality of care for adults inside hospitals. They focus on potentially avoidable complications and iatrogenic events. They'd be this particular person with the question was interested in knowing how other CDI programs are incorporating this initiative into their program, if they are and how they're doing it. I thought maybe we could just wrap up here with a little discussion of this.
Well, thank you, Brian. This is very important, obviously, because PSIs, or the patient safety indicators, are now core measures within Medicare and will have an impact on reimbursement on down the line. Very quickly, the present on admission indicator is absolutely crucial in this, and PSIs have to do with the identified conditions have to not be present on admission. So either the status code of N or status code of U factors into this. Another one that's really, really tricky is the postoperative respiratory failure. Coding Clinic, September, October 1987, said that code 518.5 which is pulmonary insufficiency following trauma and surgery, is what is assigned when respiratory failure occurs following surgery or trauma. And believe it or not, code 518.5 is not on the PSI list. What's on the PSI list is 518.81 or 518.84. So the differentiation between 518.5 and 518.81 or 518.84 is absolutely crucial. And working with physicians, some physicians may write postoperative respiratory failure even when it's routine or expected, because that's what justifies their critical care code. Working with them to say whether it's integral to the surgery or whether it is, even qualifies as an additional diagnosis is very crucial. Brian, I've given you another group of slides from the same lecture, which you may want to post. Bob, do you have any influence or any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I'm thinking that the AHRQ needs a little help with that, because the fact that they're assigning codes that could be interpreted as due to the disease rather than due to the surgery is inappropriate to identify postoperative respiratory failure if you use postoperative as an adjective rather than as an adverb, as most surgeons do. So if a patient, the identification of that acute respiratory failure happening prior to the surgery becomes very important. When the patient has it coming through the door and you're present on admission indicator in a trauma case that's going to the operating room where the patient's already been intubated, and after the surgery is having respiratory failure because he came in with it. So that becomes important to identify. They should not be assigning 518.81 as a PSI if the disease caused the respiratory failure in the postoperative phase rather than the surgery causing the respiratory failure in the postoperative phase. 518.5 should be the code used.
Well, I encourage everybody on the phone to Google AHRQ and PSI. There is a technical specifications manual that is published, and that lets you know what codes factor into the PSIs. And, Brian, if we're allowed to put that lecture up, I have some tips in there that may be helpful to everybody.
Thank you.
And you were right in your article as well that many of the other companies who do profiles for hospitals do include 518.84, 518.81, and 518.5 as postoperative respiratory failure. Health Grades does it, Solution does it, and everybody but AHRQ.
Right. And let everybody know the current minute to the medical staff, which is in part of your medical records briefings, is a newsletter that if your facility subscribes can be distributed to the physicians, and it does touch on the issues of PSIs and provides references for your physicians to use.
I'll maybe see if we can get a copy of that for our ACTIS members that aren't subscribers, too. Before we go, this kind of bridges on another topic I had asked Dr. Gold maybe to do just a brief update on before we hang up here. Dr. Gold, I think this was related to, correct me if I'm wrong, was it to the sponge count and surgical complications and what should and shouldn't be counted as a complication?
Yes. I had done a presentation about a year and a quarter ago with Lena Wilson on postoperative complications, and during that presentation, I presented a case of a sponge that was removed from the patient's body during the sponge count, but apparently after the opening in the patient's anterior vaginal vault had been closed, so they had to remove that one whip stitch to remove the lap pad, and Coding Clinic refers to that exact same case because both of them came from the same source, a hospital in Houston, Texas. They said, no, you are supposed to assign 9984, a foreign body accidentally left in the wound, because National Quality Forum's definition of end of surgery says that it's either the cessation of anesthesia, the closure of the wound, or leaving the OR. And so Coding Clinic was right in its advice. The problem is National Quality Forum was wrong in its definition of end of surgery. and through work with AHRQ, National Quality Forum, the American College of Surgeons, and the American Association of OR Nurses, we have gotten the definition of end of surgery to be changed. It is in the process of being voted on right now. This will be probably implemented in December, so that the end of surgery will be defined as anesthesia is ended and the wound is closed and the patient leaves the OR site, rather than or, and therefore coding clinic advice will have to be revised, because if the patient leaves the operating room without a foreign body in place, you should not code that as foreign body was left in place. You can see that on the National Quality Forum website.
All right. I appreciate it, Dr. Gold. For now, that coding clinic has not changed, but it looks like it may be coming, and I appreciate the update. Well, I think that should about do it. Do we have any other members dialed in at all, LaTanya? Or if not, at this time we can disconnect. I appreciate all of our members for dialing in. We did have over 200 members listening to today's call. For those that would like to again listen to it, may have missed part of it. We do post these calls to the website on our quarterly conference calls archives. Those are generally up within 2 days of the call. So please check back, and you can listen at your leisure. At this time, ladies and gentlemen, you may disconnect, and have a great rest of the day and a great Thanksgiving.